It's hard to open a restaurant and make a go of it in boom times. So what about in more challenging economic times like now? Well, people continue to open restaurants, and we decided to invite two chef owners to tell us how they've been coping. Sosie Hublitz, who's Wadi and Meg on 248 Court Street in Brooklyn, opened this past May, and Danielle Ballou, who's DBGB Kitchen and Bar at 299 Bowery and Houston, opened in June. Also with us for a broader perspective on the situation is Pamela Parsegian, executive food editor of Nation's Restaurant News. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Linda.
Daniel and Sosie, when you began your projects, I don't care which one of you starts, was there already an economic downturn in the works, or did this come along as you were putting the projects together?
There was most certainly an economic downturn in the works when I started, especially personally. For me, there was a great economic struggle going on, as well as the economy itself.
So did you ever ask yourself, what the heck am I doing? Maybe I should call the whole thing off?
No, I can't do that because this is what I do. This is what I do, and I do it well. So I didn't really have a choice.
In your case, Danielle, the Times reported that you were planning to open DBGB no matter what. And then
yes.
This came along. It's almost like, I don't know if it's fortuitous because you got a lot of other restaurants.
Yes, but at the same time, I wasn't planning to do anything fancy. I was really wanted to be very approachable, very different from all my other restaurants, and yet stay French in what I'm good at. And I think the 2 years before I opened, I was planning to do the planning was to do it very casual. Does not mean you make a cheaper, you build a cheaper restaurant for that matter. Try to create a casual restaurant don't mean then you don't have to provide air conditioning and only serve
chicken.
Voilà, exactly, and all the comfort. So it's still an expensive thing, and we could not cut down so much on budget thing. Then, we are going into a difficult economic time. Maybe we should spend half of the money we are planning to spend to do the restaurant because it was basically impossible. We could renegotiate here and there a certain area and maybe reevaluate also, but by maybe a 10 to 15% margin we saved on building. So that was frustrating because I wish, in this economic time, it's always better to spend less.
Did you make adjustments, Sosie, along the way? Or?
Yes, most certainly. My situation was a bit different in that I found the space before I had my financing together. So I was piecing together each different layer. As you know, Daniel, it starts with the mechanical and moves into structural and then decoration, et cetera, et cetera. So every time I reached a different stage, I would have to reevaluate what I could afford and what I couldn't. And
what you were going to serve as well?
I didn't deal with that until the end.
Yeah. And that's the last thing you want to really spare.
Yeah. The menu comes.
You don't mind to buy a cheaper glass or something, but you don't want to just buy a cheaper ingredient just to make it cheaper.
It's true.
Well, Pamela, how does New York City compare in terms of opening restaurants with the rest of the country? Because every week we still read about restaurants opening in New York despite all of the fears that people have.
Well, it sounds like this is exactly what's happening around the country. And as Danielle's saying, value perception is still key. Consumers are more interested now in value than they've ever been. So as hard as it is to open right now, they're more conscious on how much they're spending and what they're getting. So quality of ingredients is going up.
Well, I read it.
And I think I think also then the middle range of restaurant where sometime it was maybe a little bit more corporate type of restaurant or restaurant with not really a strong identity or a strong program or very trendy and all that has suffered much more. I see at Danielle, for example, we haven't seen, maybe because we redesigned the place also, but in all our restaurants, I think we maintain a very, very steady business.
Well, but you had a special situation. The day that the economic crisis hit, you got a 4-star review in the New York Times. That does not hurt, Danielle.
Well, yes, Yes, but still, we still make effort to make sure that you know, we are sensitive to what's happening and offering special offer to the guests despite that.
So there's, according to a report I read a few months ago, the national restaurant traffic dropped for a second consecutive quarter, and I'm assuming that that happened for the third quarter as well. And that's across the board, or is that, as Danielle suggests, only in the middle range?
Well,
which is often the only range in a lot of towns in America.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the chain restaurants, which are a larger percentage of the whole industry, especially the top 200 chains, are still profiting, but they're profiting less. So we do a report. It's called the top 100 restaurants. And in that, the numbers are down to 3.85% growth from 2007 to 2008. 2006 to 2007 was 5.4% growth. So you can see it's down a lot, and it's expected to go, that profit's expected to go down even further, according to experts.
Well, there's that old joke that the way to make a small fortune in the restaurant business is to start with a big fortune. So
you mean to be in debt?
No, you have to start up rich. Anyway.
I don't know about that. That doesn't happen to me.
Well, you, you've had great success. This is your 10th restaurant, but your first casual fare place. So you must
not
have
the first. I think Barboulou is quite casual, and DB Bistro was already. But DBGB, I think it's a place where, you know, not only guests come back more quite often because they know that the price point and the versatility of the menu and the choice are very, very, very honest and very affordable, but also I think the ambiance and I don't know. I think I like. I mean, I'm very happy with having gone casual.
Well, we'll get into ambiance in a little bit. My guests are Danielle Ballou, Sosie Hublitz. Both have new restaurants that recently opened that reflect the economic downturn. At the same time, have not sacrificed the quality of the food. Pamela Parsigian, who's executive food editor at Nation's Restaurant News. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Sosie, I would have thought that you'd feel almost a little gun-shy. A previous restaurant of yours, the Kitchen Table in Richmond, Virginia, was completely destroyed by flooding in 2004. And so was your house there?
Yes, it was. It was. It was an extraordinary experience.
That was Gaston, Tropical Storm
Gaston, yes. It rained.
Were you going to blame the French on that?
Oh, well, no. We won't do that. I am having dinner at Danielle's tonight, so.
But a little economic downturn must have seemed like a small potatoes in comparison to Gaston.
Yeah, they're of different magnitude. When you lose everything that you've worked for over, you know, over a decade, it's a different feeling than just a struggle with what the economy's doing. I chose to move forward. I said this earlier. Now this is what I do, and I sort of equate it to being a musician or an artist or a writer. If the economy is going to take a downturn, it doesn't mean you're going to stop writing or stop painting or stop playing music.
But people might stop coming to the concert.
Well, I don't know. They might stop coming to the concert, but I think people want to be entertained. They want to be fed, and they want to be made felt special, even if the economy is struggling.
Well, both of you have opened up restaurants in lower rent areas, haven't you? You're in Cobble Hill, which has become a kind of restaurant destination area, but still,
absolutely,
I would assume that it's easier to open up a restaurant in Brooklyn than it would be in Manhattan.
Oh, I disagree, only because we're still doing the same thing. It doesn't matter to me if you're in a rural part of the country.
Same challenge.
Yeah, the same challenge. You have the
same. But the rents are lower. And rent is a major part of the restaurant business.
It's all relative to what you put on the menu. It's an equation, a mathematical equation.
And it's also relative to the traffic you have in your restaurant. And I think, I don't know, in Brooklyn, can you be open very late? Yeah,
yes.
You serve late?
Yes, you can.
So that's good.
It is, but we don't have the foot traffic, which is a good point that you make, Leonard. We don't have the foot traffic that Manhattan does, say, after 1 o'clock.
Do you have a lot of walk-in in your restaurant?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We don't take reservations.
Oh, okay. So that's even easier.
Yeah.
And that's the way...
So it's always full.
Always full.
And that's the way some restaurants that are working on a tighter budget work. They don't take reservations because then a table doesn't sit idle for a while. If people mm-hmm. show up late or don't show up at all.
That's right.
Yeah, but then for me, I mean, the case in Manhattan... with DBGB, I mean, we have to take some reservation because otherwise it becomes difficult. I mean, it all depends also to what extent the customer expect to have his table when he come in or if he knows the place. I mean, you know.
So true, yeah.
I think going for a non-reservation restaurant, it's something you have to get used to run.
But in your restaurant is much bigger than Wadi and Meg.
Mm-hmm.
Why Wadi and Meg?
Oh, Wadi and Meg. I didn't have a name for this particular restaurant. I think this is my eighth restaurant. I didn't have a name up until, I think, 2 weeks before we opened. And Wadi and Meg, they were two people that worked at my very first restaurant, Millie's Diner, in Richmond, Virginia. And Wadi, who's a very well-known jazz musician now, plays in the city all the time, has been my friend over the years. And I was talking to about this earlier. They were a couple at the restaurant, and I cooked out in front of everybody. It was a small 18-seat diner. And you'd see me cooking when you walked in, and Wadi and Meg were the servers, or two of them, and they always had a lot of drama going on, and it would spill over into the life of the restaurant. So,
lovers; they were just servers.
They were lovers.
Oh, they were lovers
yes,
too.
Yes, they
okay.
were. There's a lot of I call it passion and entropy and chaos.
Do you want a lot of drama in a restaurant?
No.
They said there enough drama.
No, but I think it's a cute story to take.
Now, DBGB makes more. It makes a lot of sense when you're opening a restaurant in the Bowery and at the Bowery in Houston because CBGB's is just a few blocks north.
Well, it was a block north, yeah, on First Street between First and Second. No. But that was just a play on word, and it happened, and we kept it, and we, of course, sit down with the people of CBGB and say, that's what we're going to do. Is that okay? Otherwise, we just decide not. And they say, as long as you don't sell T-shirts and hats and all that, it'll be okay. So,
now, Pablo, if you were giving advice, would you tell Sosi it's a better idea to open a restaurant in Brooklyn than in Richmond, Virginia?
No. I think it's hard to open a restaurant anywhere, and I admire anyone who can do it successfully. It's really tough. I heard a really fun way to succeed that surprised me. We were interviewing Mario Batali, and he said that it was actually at the Food and Wine Festival. He said what he does is he gives his suppliers 3 months of not paying bills when the restaurant mm-hmm. opens, and that they're basically helping to fund his restaurant. So mm-hmm. that's a great little trick, no matter where you are.
Well, but if you're Mario Batali, you can pull it off. Not everybody can.
At the same time, when you open a new place, you don't want to feel too restrained by financial. Otherwise, it's very difficult to go up the ramp. And
it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah, no, it's true. But I went yesterday to Mario's and Joe's new restaurant in Rochester. Portchester. Portchester, New York.
I was worried. Rochester. It didn't seem to me like a resting destination city.
But Portchester, I mean, and the restaurant is busy all the time. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. a beautiful place.
My guests are Daniel Ballou, Sosi Hublitz. Danielle's new restaurant is DBGB Kitchen and Bar. Sosi's is Wadi and Meg. They are both reflecting changes in the economy. And Pamela Parsigian is here. She's the executive food editor of Nation's Restaurant News. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with restaurateurs Sosi Hublitz, who is the chef, designer, and owner of Wadi and Meg at 248 Court Street in Brooklyn. Daniel Ballou, who's the chef owner of DBGB Kitchen and Bar at 299 Bowery at Houston Street. They both opened recently, Wadi and Meg in May, DBGB in June. Also with us is Pamela Parsigian, executive food editor at Nation's Restaurant News. I don't want to make it sound like this is the only restaurant you have, Danielle. This is your fifth in New York and your yes. tenth all over the world?
Yes.
Okay, well, don't be shy. I would assume that one of the major adjustments that you make during an economic downturn is with ingredients, because you just cannot include the most expensive things. For example, expensive herbs, mushrooms, whatever in the sauces. You're more likely to not serve the most expensive cut of beef or the most expensive.
No, it's not true. I think a creative chef and a chef with a true soul can make wonderful food without having to spend money, I think, and by having very good ingredients. And I think
so you're going to the same suppliers you go to for the other
always.
Restaurants?
Always. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. No. Our supplier is the most important thing we have and the most important thing we trust. And I think we cannot jeopardize our reputation. And I would say, I mean, my reputation as a chef with going cheaper ingredient.
Because I had a
but that's not mean we don't negotiate with our suppliers. I mean, with five restaurants, I have more leverage to negotiate, and we can sometimes ask them to be a little bit more sensitive, especially special ingredient where we use all the other restaurants use that particular supply. Could be an olive oil to cook with, or it could be a major kind of basic supply. Mm-hmm. But the fresh food, meat, fish, vegetables, and fruits, and all that, it's to the chef de cuisine itself to decide with me which suppliers you want to go with. And
yeah, but you're going to serve hanger steak at a less expensive restaurant and not ribeye.
Yes, but depends. In that case, I will serve both. Because the one we want to go premium can afford and will go for it. But definitely we might sell 80% Angus steak and 20% ribeye, but we still have the upsell in case a customer want to go for it.
So you were nodding your head.
Yeah, it's true. You know, I started out with a hanger steak, and everybody wanted a ribeye, you know, quite frankly. And I did exactly what Daniel just said. We're both on the menu, and you know the hanger steak. It all depends on the application, right? And once again, the chef de cuisine and the creativity and the latitude that they have to be able to make that dish spectacular.
In the end, it's all about whether you deliver flavor, isn't it? And you can deliver flavor even
yes.
with a nice piece of chicken. In fact, they used to say that the best way to judge a chef is to get roast chicken. Which is one
yeah,
of the simplest
you give him the most
dishes.
Sample ingredient and see what he can do
that's,
with it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And it definitely has to be more interesting than what you can do at home. Otherwise, you stay home and do it yourself.
Pamela, what are you hearing from restaurants around the country?
Yeah, they're definitely doing this. They're providing options. And it's so mm-hmm. smart to have the wide variety. And what I liked before we came on air, Danielle and I were just talking about what goes in his burger. So he is using that delicious deckle on the outside mm-hmm. of the prime rib where all the fat and flavor is. It gets ground up into that burger. So it's a matter of being creative. Mm-hmm. Using that, maybe it used to go to your family meal. Is that where that deckle used to go?
Yeah, also, plus at Danielle, we use the ribeye a lot. But so I keep the decal and then ship them to DBGB, and they have that wonderful aged fat also to put into the ground meat. And also I want to grind my meat because I want consistency and I want to know what goes in. And I want to make sure the meat is fresh and perfectly trimmed and all that. It's a little bit obsessive because, you can get ground meat anywhere in New York as long as you give them sort of the ratio of what you want to grind.
But it's important. You're saying it's important if you want quality control to do
very
it yourself.
Much. I mean, we have 14 sausage on the menu. I am making every sausage, including the hot dog. I mean, I can find easily 50 hot dog makers within the radius of 200 miles of New York to produce me the hot dog. No, I want to produce it myself. I want to know what's going inside. And also, we produce the buns ourselves, and we produce all the buns for our burger. And, you know, a hot dog is is like $9 on the menu or something. But it's nine full value dollar. It's not something.
Do I get sauerkraut with that?
No, you get onion confit, and we make our own sort of Piccadilly pickles.
Can you do all of that? You have a very small restaurant, so I see.
I cannot do all of that. One of the ways that I had to cut costs was with what I have in the kitchen, my equipment, you know, down to the prep tables that I've chosen. And it's a challenge, you know. But what happens with that is you see, in terms of my chef and my sous chef and the line cooks, you know, how creative they can be, how patient they can be, and the learning curve for them is a bigger challenge. And that, in a way, is a gift, you know, for somebody who's coming into a kitchen and wants to really perform. They have to do a lot of things by hand because I don't have that kind of equipment or that kind of space. It just to hear Danielle talk about that is just so luxury for me right now. In other restaurants, I, of course, have had wonderful production kitchens, but this one being so small and my budget being so small to work with has left a lot of challenges. And as a matter of fact, I am closing for a few days at the end of the month to do a few renovations in the back of the house and in the kitchen so we can start to produce more ourselves.
And how many seats do you have in your restaurant?
I have 120. We have a beautiful patio outside. It's on a corner. I'm thinking about enclosing that in the winter, and otherwise it'll drop down to about 80 seats, I believe.
And how many at DBGB?
About 130 in the dining room, and then a bar area where it's about 40 seats, 30 seats.
Mm-hmm. So actually they're not all that different in size.
Yeah.
Now, the bar is an important matter for a lot of restaurants. Some restaurants say that the only reason they make a profit is because they have a bar.
I don't know.
But in an article in the New York Times, you made it clear that you didn't want your DBGB to become a bar that also served food.
Well, now it's a bar who serve food, yes. It's because at the beginning is we didn't want to serve the whole menu at the bar. Mm-hmm. And we have 24 beer on draft. We have a lot of selection of wines and beers. And it's mostly if you're interested about what you drink, more than the matter of drinking, I think it's very, very, it's a very interesting bar. But then people want food after a certain time. 8:30 at night or something, people want to eat. So now in the bar, we serve the same menu all over the bar, the front.
What I was aiming at, and maybe this is something you can do, Sosi, because you have a bar in your place as well. A lot of restaurants make pretty much their profit on the bar, and then they have to decide whether they want to stress the bar or they want to stress the food.
There's a balance to strike between that. There's an art to that, too, with the way you present yourself and the way your staff presents the restaurant as well. In Cobble Hill, I have a beer and wine license right now. I have to pass approval by the community board to get full liquor license, which is coming soon. Another huge challenge because it takes an economic hit. Yes, it's true. You do make a bigger profit off the bar. These are the risks we're taking, you know?
I know. But that's one thing, for example, for me, I will not go in business if I cannot guarantee it and I have a full liquor license. Mm-hmm. Because it's like you say, it hurts you at the end.
Yeah.
A little bit. Not much by margin of percentage of revenue, but more by revenue of profit. I mean,
does that make it harder to open a restaurant in New York than in some other parts of the country?
I think so.
Could be.
Though it's hard to get a liquor license in a lot of parts of the country.
That's very, very true. They're also they're expensive in other. I know in Los Angeles it can cost up to $30,000, $40,000, $50,000.
Oh my God!
However, in the state of Virginia, I think my liquor license was $700.
But that's because you were allowed to carry concealed weapons, so you could always threaten the guy at the license office.
Exactly.
you suggest that it's different everywhere, and I'm assuming that means different strategies are developed everywhere.
Right, but everywhere it's true that the profit margin is terrific on beverages, and not just alcohol beverage, coffee, tea. So a lot of restaurateurs are being super smart these days and coming up with wonderful drinks of all kinds, and it's working, I think.
But it's inevitable. I mean, you have to realize then there is a limitation also to how much you can earn revenue with food. And food, of course, when you charge $10 for or $15 for a plate, There's the labor inside. There's the cost of food. There's the waste. There's the rent. There's everything. And then after, you have the beverage. And so a bar business can save a business often by having much less application of labor into the cost of the beverage, and so a greater margin of profit. But that profitability at the end goes to help the rest of the restaurant. You can afford to have better food. You can afford to have better things in your restaurant, and that's inevitable. And I think while, of course, if you start to pay $20 for a martini, that's a little bit pushy.
But even within the menu, I'm sure that you charge more for certain ingredients that cost less to make up for the ingredients that the other dishes that would cost more.
No, certain ingredients have a better margin of profit than other. And you know than some other, you are right on the red line. But it's important to have it for part of the prestige of the restaurant and all that.
So, so chicken you can make more money on a chicken or salmon.
If you put morel or chanterelle on it, not so much.
Yeah, it depends, you know.
But you're right about the beverages now are being more profitable, but there are also
more
creativities going into them.
Absolutely.
Do you think it was ignored for too long?
No, but it was just predictable. I mean, bartenders weren't so creative. And I mean, today we have no more bartender, we have mixologists. Mm-hmm. So it's very different. They really are. I mean, the other night with my manager and my bartender, actually, we did the tour of Brooklyn and Queens. We started with Queens and we started at Dutch Kill. And then after we went to Brooklyn to a couple of places and to just see the bar, because I heard that there were some wonderful bars there doing wonderful work. And it was a fun thing. But next time I'll stop to your place.
That's great. That's great. It's true, actually, though. You know, I was talking to my bar manager, LR, and he was making a drink, and I was watching him, and he was tasting it, and he was analyzing everything in it, and he was using words like, oh, there's cinnamon, and he was talking about it as if it were, you know, a culinary experience. And I was really delighted to see a young person, you know, applying this kind of scrutiny to his craft.
Now, how important is it to establish some kind of a sense of a personality of a restaurant? I'll walk into some restaurants and I'll think, this place doesn't want me. They're playing music that is addressing itself to a different demographic, louder than I would like, because I do like to talk when I have a meal. But it could also be the other way around. It could turn some people off because it could feel a little too old fogyish. How do you work that out? in your case, when you were associate, when you're putting together Wadi Meg, because you designed it as well, were you thinking about who would come to your restaurant?
Oh, no. I have a whole philosophy on this. I believe that when you find a space, and this works for me, I have to say, when you find a space and you begin to design it, as you strip off the layers of sheetrock and the old lighting and you get down to the bones of the building starts to speak to you. Mm-hmm. And it starts to take a shape of its own and a life of its own, and it begins to have its own feeling. And I find that in that is a lot of authenticity and a lot of levity, too. You start to sort of have a relationship with the space, and it defines itself for you.
You know. Well, when you opened up Danielle, you were opening it in a space that you had worked in earlier when it was Le Cirque. That had a real strong personality for you.
Yeah,
you
but
had
to Le Cirque was already 20 years old, and did I want to carry the clientele of Le Cirque really? No, I wanted to create my own and go through the generation. I think there's no problem of how old you are and all that. It's just how do you approach each guest and make them feel special. But at DBGB, for example, the case of loud music, the case of a loud place, the case of a very much younger, hipper place for maybe somebody a little older. It can be shocking, but I see a lot of customers coming with their children, which are in their early 20s. So people are in their 50s, 60s, and they feel young, and they want to go out with their children. And sometimes they come together, and they feel like, oh, this is the perfect place to go together, where both generations are happy. But it's much younger, for sure. It's much younger than what I expected, and that's good, except at the same time, I don't want to be trendy, and I want to make sure then our customer come back. And so we cannot just make the other feel unhappy because we want to just target to the young one.
Are there certain trends in restaurants around the country these days, especially with the economic downturn?
Yeah, I think that the most interesting trend I've seen as far as food trends go is Peruvian. I think that you're going to see more Peruvian restaurants opening. And I say that...
You mean all over the country?
I think all over the country.
But they have their limitation on repertoire. I've been to Peru. I mean, I didn't see...
Chicken and potatoes.
It's a big country, and it's got a lot of climates up and down. And there's a gentleman who's... he's opening his 33rd restaurant. He's got them around the world in 14 countries. His name is Gaston. He opened La Mer in San Francisco. That's his first U.S. restaurant. And now he's looking in New York. And he'll be opening, I think, very soon. And he does a fabulous job. So that's my point.
I'm thinking about the last economic downturn and the number of moderately priced restaurants opened, like JoJo's. And then... When the economy improved, the prices suddenly went up. Do you think the same thing is going to happen this time?
No. I think that, people are now – this was a more serious economic downturn. People are really used to quality and that perception of value, and they're not going to go backwards.
Of course, the economy is built into DBGB, so you're not going to jack up the prices because –
Even Café Boulou on 76th Street is 10 years old this year. We are in the middle of an economic crisis, but came to the point where I wanted to redo the restaurant. And so we are closing for a month and a half and reinvesting into it, redoing the entire restaurant. And the price are the same as 10 years ago.
My guests have been Daniel Boulou, chef owner of many restaurants, including DBGB Kitchen and Bar at 299 Bowery, Sosie Hublitz, the chef designer and owner of Wadi and Meg on Court Street, and Pamela Parsegian. Thank you so much. On Tuesday's show, we'll look at the state of the American newspaper from Philadelphia, which may soon be without a daily paper, to Seattle, where the last surviving paper has just turned a profit. Also, Studio 360's Kurt Anderson on Reset on the positive things he thinks will come out of the economic downturn. And then we'll speak to filmmaker Dan Cloris about his Peabody-winning documentary Black Magic. Plus, our latest projections segment looks at how journalism has been portrayed on film. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Alex Conrad, Natalie Pano, and Paula Crossfield. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.